Fabulous. Huh? Well, most of you probably don't remember. Last fall, I spoke on response to rebuke. All of us have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, and all of us have done things wrong, whether it be intentional or unintentional, based on misunderstandings, based on our own desires. And so, we've all had to be corrected. Just show a raise of hands. How many of you can recall a time where you really messed up and you felt really lame when someone confronted you about it? I'm guessing at least all the husbands' hands should go up. No? Okay. Well, the five of you that raise your hands, I'm preaching to you tonight. So we looked at last time what it looks like when a person responds in a bad way to rebuke. We looked at stories where a king threw a temper tantrum because he didn't get his way. The other king responded with pride because he thought it was this great king, and why should he be dethroned? And we looked at some of the apostles responding in really a childish way. And we had, I think it was 9 or 11 examples they came up with, and obviously there's many more. And this time I wanted to look at some holy responses to rebuke. And we're only considering rebukes that are accurate. We all know that we've been falsely accused before. Most of us likely have. And I think that it deserves its own response. But tonight we're going to look at when somebody actually did mess up. They were rebuked for it. How did they respond? So if you'll turn with me to 2 Samuel, we'll begin there. And don't worry too much about getting those blanks filled in on those worksheets handed out. We're going to review at the end. I want you to catch the message rather than just worry about filling in some blanks. But here in 2 Samuel, we'll look at the story of David and Nathan. I'll just go ahead and start reading in chapter 12. The Lord sent Nathan to David. When he came to him, he said, "There were two men in a certain town, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a very large number of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb that he had bought. He raised it, and it grew up with him and his children. He shared his food, drank from his cup, and even slept in his arms. He was like a daughter to him. Now a traveler came to a rich man, but the rich man refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for the traveler who had come to him. Instead, he took the ewe lamb that belonged to the poor man and prepared it for the one who had come to him." Bad, right? And David got really mad at this. Here he is, the king of Israel, and he's a shepherd of these people, and he's hearing about this story that this guy did, and he gets mad. So looking at verse 5, David burned with anger against the man and said to Nathan, "As surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this deserves to die. He must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing and had no pity." So he gives a pretty harsh condemnation against this man. And we all know how the story continues. Then Nathan said to David, "You are the man. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave your master's house to you, and your master's wives into your arms. I gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if all this had been too little, I would have given you even more. Why did you despise the word of the Lord by doing what is evil in his eyes? You struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword and took his wife to be your own." By the way, do you guys, I don't know if you guys know this, but if you follow up the genealogies, you find out that Uriah was actually related to David. Looks like he was a cousin to him. I can't provide chapter and verse, so don't take that as truth. I encourage you to go look it up in the genealogies, but I'm sure you'll find it there. I found it. Either way, you struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword and took his wife to be your own. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now therefore the sword will never depart from your house, because you despised me and took the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your own. This is what the Lord says. Out of your own household, I am going to bring calamity upon you. Before your very eyes, I will take your wives and give them to one who is close to you, and he will lie with your wives in broad daylight. You did it in secret, but I will do this thing in broad daylight before all of Israel. Now imagine, if you can, putting yourself in David's position. You know, you've done this, you're in a high position of authority. You know, you're anointed by God to be where you're at. And you do this foolish thing. I mean, you commit murder, adultery. You're supposed to be the king, the leader of your people. You think you got it all managed and swept under the rug. You think things are taken care of. And this man comes to you and tells you a story. And he gets your emotions all hyped up. And you find out he tricked you. You find out he set you up. And then you pronounce condemnation against yourself. You said that you yourself deserve to die. Right? And then Nathan says, you are that man. And you realize that you pronounced it on yourself. I'd be a little upset at Nathan. You know, and as a king, I imagine he had the authority to have him murdered, you know, have him executed. He was in, you know, David was traveling with his people. You know, it's doubtful that he was alone. And so, there's this embarrassment now, right? So imagine yourself being embarrassed and called out. There's no way you can get around it now. It's been laid out there. And how would you feel?
Lame.
How else would you feel? Okay. Would you get upset? Anybody? Would you be thinking of a way to get out of it? I would. Unfortunately. But tonight we're looking at a holy response to rebuke. Not how Chris would always respond to rebuke. So looking at verse 15, this is what the Lord says. Oh, I'm sorry. Verse 13. Then David said to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. Nathan replied, the Lord has taken away your sin. You are not going to die. But because by doing this you have made the enemies of the Lord show utter contempt, the son born to you will die. So, correct response started by first admitting it. You know, he confessed his sin. He didn't try to hide it. Doesn't show that he tried to do anything else except he just said, I didn't. And then, so Nathan tells him, that the Lord will take away your sin, but there's going to be a punishment still. And, you know, he says that his actions made the enemies of the Lord hold him in contempt. You know, and that's a shameful thing. I mean, how would you feel if a prophet came to you and told you your actions have caused non-Christians now to decide that they don't want to follow Christ, but, you know, they have contempt for Christ because of what you've done? I think, again, you're faced with another choice that's hard. How are you going to respond to that? Are you going to continue to crucify yourself and humble yourself, swallow your pride? That's a choice you're not presented with again. So in verse 15, after Nathan had gone home, the Lord struck the child that Uriah's wife had born to David, and he became ill. David pleaded with God for the child. He fasted and went into his house and spent the nights lying on the ground. The elders of his household stood beside him to get him up from the ground, but he refused, and he would not eat any food with them. But this is the king, the one person in the whole country who had the most right to luxuries. And he's humbling himself. He's sleeping on the ground, refusing to eat. On the seventh day, the child died. David's servants were afraid to tell him that the child was dead, for they thought, while the child was still living, we spoke to David, but he would not listen to us. How can we tell him the child is dead? He may do something desperate. Do any of you guys know why they thought that? What's that? Do you know why they feared him? Does anybody remember what happened the last few times someone brought news to David that someone died? Killed him. And who did they bring news to him that died? Who did they say died?
Saul.
He was one. One of his enemies. Somebody came and said, your enemy's been killed. You know, even one of the times it was the guys that killed him for him. David immediately rebuked him and said, how are you to lay your hand on these people? And he had them executed for bringing that that message that these people had died. So now David's own son is dead, the one he'd been weeping for all week. And they got to tell him the news? That's why they feared. But David noticed that his servants were whispering among themselves, and he realized the child was dead. Is the child dead, he asked? Yes, they replied, he is dead. So here's a moment. Again, David's faced with a choice, how to respond. And here their lives are in danger. Then David got up from the ground. After he had washed, put on lotions, and changed his clothes, he went into the house of the Lord and worshipped. Then he went to his own house, and at his request they served him food, and he ate. His servants asked him, why are you acting this way? While the child was alive, you fasted and wept. But now that the child is dead, you get up and eat. He answered, while the child was still alive, I fasted and wept. I thought, who knows? The Lord may be gracious to me and let the child live. Now that he is dead, why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I will go to him, but he will not return to me. So we see that while David was weeping and fasting and praying, it wasn't just out of a self-pity sorrow. His response to rebuke was number one, remorse. David had remorse for what he did, and he admitted it, so I have sinned against the Lord. And then his next response was to seek out amends, or seek out a way for God to have grace on those that he had harmed. It was because of his sinful action that this child was going to die. And David spent that whole time after he had got his condemnation doing what he could to see that the child would survive. He wasn't concerned with himself. He didn't sit in the luxuries. He didn't eat. He wasn't concerned with himself. And I think that's something that we need to remember. Although we may not ever face a similar case, we will respond to rebuke. We will be rebuked, most likely. And how will we respond? Are we going to have remorse? You know, are we going to admit our sin? And are we going to then try to do what we can to make things right for other people? Beseech the Lord for grace for the others that we've harmed. You know, let's make sure that that is our response and that we're not acting selfishly. So that's the story of David and Nathan. The second one I'd like to look at tonight is a Phoenician woman and Jesus. And if you would turn with me to Mark 7. I'm going to be reading verses 24 through 30. But Jesus left that place and went to the vicinity of Tyre. He entered a house and did not want anyone to know it, yet he could not keep his presence secret. In fact, as soon as she heard about him, a woman whose little daughter was possessed by an evil spirit came and fell at his feet. So here you have a woman whose child is demon-possessed. And I'm not a parent, but I can imagine being a parent with a child demon-possessed, you'd be a little stressed out, you know. You'd be a little depressed and you'd be pretty desperate for help. The woman was a Greek, born in Syrian Phoenicia. So here we see she's an outsider. You know, she wasn't considered part of the in crowd, you know, by the higher up Pharisees, teachers of the law. You know, she was an outcast. She begged Jesus to drive the demon out of her daughter. She begged him. Didn't say, she kind of made a passing request, you know, meekly. Just say, hey, please. She begged him. So I'm trying to set up now the picture of how desperate this woman was. If you can envision this, this woman was desperate. She really wanted to see this demon leave her child. So Jesus responds, first let the children eat all they want, he told her. For it is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs. Here you came, a desperate mother, to Jesus, the man you heard about, and you beg him, and he calls you a dog, and he rejects your request. You know, what would you do? I mean, she was an outsider. It doesn't say necessarily that she lived a sinful life. It does say that she was outside, you know, the lineage of the Jews. And she's called a dog. And how would you feel if you went to a doctor and they were of a different race and they said, oh, you're of this ethnicity, I'm not going to help you, you're a dog. You know, I imagine they would lose their license to practice medicine in short order. I imagine they would be on the news, disgraced, and they would never practice medicine, at least in this country, again. But here's Jesus, and he acted this way, you know. And so what would you do? What would you say? I mean, how would you respond to that, being laid so low? And her response is something so amazing. You don't see that kind of response today. Yes, Lord, she replied, but even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. She admitted to being a dog. It doesn't say she did anything wrong. But she knew she was outside of the lineage. And for some reason, it seems that she knew that Jesus was telling the truth. She was willing to accept what he said to her. He gave her a position and she was willing to accept it. I'd have a hard time accepting that I was a dog. Raise a hand if you wouldn't have a hard time with that. And he told her, for such a reply, you may go. The demon has left your daughter. Or even Jesus recognized. He told her she was a dog. She responded this way. And Jesus, being the source of love, recognized the humility that she had. And when we're rebuked, we need to remember that we're not always in a high place in life as we think we are. We don't always rank as high in heaven as we think we will. So we need to be able to respond with humility. If we are indeed in a lowly position and we're rebuked for it, we need to accept our lowly position and respond in humility like she did. And we see it from example right here. We can trust that our King is going to do what's right by us. He's going to take care of us. We don't have to fear that he's going to let our kids stay demon-possessed. We don't have to fear that whatever our problem is, if it's a real problem, he's going to let it continue. He's going to have grace and mercy on us, and if it's in His Word, and if it's in His will, if it's best for us, He's going to grant us our request. She went home and found her child lying on the bed and the demon gone. Let us respond to humility and see the demons gone. The third example I would like to look at is John chapter 8, if you would turn there with me. Verses 1 through 11. And Jesus begins with a self-righteous, harsh, condescending group of Pharisees and teachers of the law bringing to him a woman caught in adultery. They're trying to trap him. and they're willing to let this woman die for their cause. But Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. At dawn, he appeared again in the temple courts, where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought a woman caught in adultery, made her stand before the group, and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law of Moses commands us to stone such a woman. Now what do you say?" They're using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. So here comes these Pharisees, like I said, with this cold-hearted attitude. And they're coming hard. And Jesus doesn't respond right away. Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "If any one of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw a stone at her." Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. Now, if we're familiar with the Bibles, we know that the Pharisees and teachers of the law aren't exactly good examples on how to live. But you know, the Lord has grace. And in this case, they did do what was right afterwards when they were rebuked. I'm sure they could have gone even further and sought out more truth, but at least they responded in a correct way. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left, with the woman still standing there. Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you." Jesus declared, "Go now and leave your life of sin." Now, just to make sure no one misunderstood, our example here isn't the woman's response. It was the response of the crowd. The Pharisees and the teachers of the law, even they got it right. So we know that we have a shot. It was an acceptance of guilt. When Jesus declared that they were all guilty, they accepted that and went away and left her. So when we come, especially when we're coming to bring a rebuke against somebody else, we need to be ready and willing to accept any guilt of our own. When we're confronted with the truth that we've done something wrong, we need to be willing to accept that. And that's another good response to rebuke. In Acts 2, Peter is addressing the crowd that gathered on Pentecost. He's telling them that Christ is the one spoken about through the ages, through the prophets. Jesus was the one to come. And he comes down pretty hard on them. Verse 36, "Therefore let all Israel be assured of this. God has made this Jesus, whom you crucified, both Lord and Christ." Now, there's a big crowd there. Imagine yourself as one of these people. Well, imagine that you're one of these people that came from far away. How do you consider yourself? Probably a decently religious person, decently committed to God. You've traveled this way. You know, you were supposed to come here for this feast, and you've come. And now you're being accused of murder. You know, you're being rebuked. Here you might have felt pretty good about yourself. Now, I thought God cared about you, although at the Pentecost, people may have remembered the fact that, you know, the Lord was passing over and it was an act of grace anyway. But I'm sure through the years that people had gotten to a position of feeling pretty good about themselves for obeying these long journeys. We've seen the Jews respond to this kind of rebuke in the past in many bad ways, when they were accused by the prophets of going against God. They would respond with anger, with lies, self-pity, with murder. But this group had hearts of not of stone, but hearts of flesh. When the people heard this, they were cut to the heart and said to Peter and the other apostles, "Brothers, what shall we do?" Peter went on to tell them what they should do, and they were willing to obey. They were rebuked and they were willing to obey. Verse 41, those who accepted his message were baptized. About 3,000 were added to the number that day. Let's make sure that we're willing to obey. If we're rebuked for something we've done wrong, and we're told to do something about it, let's make sure that we're willing to obey that rebuke and do something about it. And again, on the idea of obedience, we'll look in Acts 22, and we'll see Paul respond with obedience. We read the story of him traveling on the road to Damascus on his way to persecute the church. And who confronts him but Jesus Christ himself? Instead of bringing more murderous threats, though, Paul humbles himself before the one that he sought to destroy. He obeys Jesus and asks, "What shall I do, Lord?" He calls him Lord. And he begins his life of obedience with Christ. He goes and fasts 3 days. He's told to be baptized and washed away his sins, and he obeys. And then he continues to obey through his life. You know, this one response to rebuke changed the whole outcome of who he was. Had he responded to this incorrectly and rejected Jesus, we may have had most of our New Testament written by someone else. But this one response was a pivoting place in his life. And we don't know when we're going to come to a big pivot place in our life. We may be on the wrong road doing something. You know, all of us have already, those that have already accepted Christ, came to that point once. And we accepted Christ and we gave our life over. But there may become more times where we need to respond to a rebuke and make sure our lives go right. We need to be willing to obey. Ezekiel 11:19-20 records what God will do for us, or what God wills for us. "I will give them an undivided heart and put a new spirit in them. I will remove from them their heart of stone and give them a heart of flesh. Then they will follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws. They will be my people, and I will be their God." His desire is that we will have hearts of flesh, hearts willing to change when God says change, to turn and obey when we've already disobeyed. Psalm 141 gives us a prayer that we should all pray when we consider how to respond to rebuke. And when we are rebuked, it would be good to remember this. So if you can, commit this to memory. Psalm 141, 1-5. "O Lord, I call to you, come quickly to me. Hear my voice when I call to you. May my prayer be set before you like incense. May the lifting up of my hands be like the evening sacrifice. Set a guard over my mouth, O Lord. Keep watch over the door of my lips. Let not my heart be drawn to what is evil, to take part in wicked deeds with men who are evildoers, and may not eat of their delicacies." Verse 5 being the most important when considering how to respond. "Let a righteous man strike me, it is a kindness. Let him rebuke me, it is oil on my head. My head will not refuse it." So we've seen these examples of how our hearts should respond to rebuke, and we can take these examples and see if we are living up to God's standards. On line number one there, do we respond with the same kind of remorse that David responded with? Sorry for what we're done. Number two, with the humility of the Phoenician woman, willing to accept the reality of our lowly state. Number three, with an acceptance of guilt that even the Pharisees and the teachers of the law had while charging the adulteress. Number four, with the willingness to obey that the Jews had on the day of Pentecost, or the obedience that Paul had on the road to Damascus. where we say in our hearts, let a righteous man strike me as a kindness. Let him rebuke me. It is oil on my head. My head will not refuse it. I'd like to take this time to pose a challenge. Same challenge I posed last time I preached on rebuke. The next time that you are rebuked, doesn't matter by who, take time and just stop and examine yourself for a minute. Don't worry about responding fast. Don't worry about making yourself look good. Just stop for a minute. Take time and examine your actions, the things you were doing. Examine your motives, the reasons you were doing them. And examine your goals. What is it that you're really trying to achieve anyway? In each of these areas, test to see if you're responding to rebuke in the same way they did in the stories that we just shared in the Bible. And God has given us the ability to respond to rebuke. And thank God for that. He has given us the free will to choose whether to respond in a sinful manner or in a godly manner. How will you respond?